A weirdo, and you're listening to Tell Me Something Weird. This is a weekly podcast in which I, sunshine absorber, Eric Johnson, tells a story of some fairly well-established but still a little weird American history.
Oh.
To you with my, I screwed this whole thing up.
Just roll with it. This is real.
With my brightly shining co-host,
Jody Arnold.
It'll be better. This will be better next week, guys.
Yeah. We're still, well, I'm going to tell you about a serial killer.
I feel like this, we're getting better at this every single time.
Yeah.
You know, it's flowing smooth. we're getting a lot of practice. This is episode like 64.
Yes, I know.
We still don't have that down.
Well, we only got it down like halfway through in the first place.
Yeah. So,
and I have a perpetual cold, so I apologize.
Yeah, I think that's just kind of becoming like your podcast voice.
Yeah, I know. I'm like a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
Who's just sick all the time. Yeah. That's what's happening to me. That's probably because I've been burning the candle at both ends, you know what I mean?
Yeah. How's that stuff going? If you want to even talk about it on the show.
Well, guess what? When you listen to this episode, I will have defended my prospectus for my thesis, which is a book I'm writing that you have to convince the university that the idea you have is worthy, and you have to do it in front of a council who listens to your proposal that you have written and they've read and they come at you with questions and stuff. So I got that going on. And hey, guess what? On Saturday, October 28th at 6 p.m. at the local store, I am reading one of my, some creative nonfiction for Independent Bookstore Day. So there's like the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild I'm part of. Asked me to read there, so I'm reading there at 6 p.m.
Put it in your weird-ass calendars.
Yeah, because that's a cool venue, and we have not made any announcements yet, but we plan on doing an event there with Miss D. Lovely in the next few months. Maybe you're going to get a history lesson at that event.
Yeah, that's going to be... I'm super looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
We just have to do a few things before we can announce it.
Yeah, and speaking of Miss D, thank you to everybody who came out to the live show. That was such a fantastic night.
It was so fun.
And, you know, again, no date set, but we're probably going to do it again.
Yep.
In a little while. So we'll let you know when that happens. So if you missed it this time, there's going to be another chance. But who knows what's going to happen after that. So you better come out.
Right. Do it.
It was super fun. I can't believe how much fun that was.
Yeah, it was. And Miss D was really great, as was Robert Dudley. And we're having him on the show again before his book release, which he told me is going to be the end of July. And he was very stressed about it because I'd been hassling him during the live show. Yeah. Like, you got that deadline, you know.
So you said it out loud now. Like, you know, people are expecting it.
Right. So speaking of the live show, one of the things we were talking about was movies that we've walked out on.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? I walked out on another movie this weekend.
Oh, that's becoming a habit now.
Well, now there was only 20 minutes left in the movie.
What was it?
I'm embarrassed to admit this because this movie on paper is everything I should want out of a movie. Mostly. Isle of Dogs, the Wes Anderson film.
Whoa.
We left.
Was it just really bad or what?
Yes. I loved The Fantastic Mr. Fox. Did you ever see it?
Yeah, that was great.
Okay. So it's stop motion animation, just like that. and it's dogs.
Which, you know, I'm on board already. You're going to have to really bring it to dissuade me from seeing a movie like about dogs.
It's
now, if you tell me a bunch of dogs die, then I'm out immediately. I don't want to feel that.
The dogs don't die, but they are exiled to this island of garbage because they have a disease and they are overrunning this this Japanese city. It might be all of Japan or an island or something. But Wes Anderson is really quirky, and usually his quirkiness just fits perfectly with the movie. You know, like, there's enough of a storyline where he can be afforded the space to do some quirky stuff that still ties in. But this movie lacked a foundation that was strong enough. All the quirkiness fell flat. It was boring. Nobody laughed at anything. It was slow.
Well, it's what happens when you go to a movie with a bunch of humorless fucks.
Well, I was at that movie fully prepared, I will say, to have a psychedelic Wes Anderson experience. And even under such conditions.
It still failed to meet those conditions or those expectations? That's crazy.
It wasn't funny. It was slow. Half the movie is in Japanese with no translation.
There's a way to do that. You know, you look at a movie like WALL-E, you know, that didn't have a lot of dialogue and stuff. Like, you can do either no dialogue or dialogue in a foreign language.
Yep.
You know, that most of the audience isn't gonna understand. I mean, I'm sure, you know, the Japanese audience is fine.
Yeah.
Our Japanese fans probably loved it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there's stories about what it's like to see that movie as a Japanese speaker.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I'll share one of those articles.
Okay. But there's an artful way to do that, you know, where the dialogue or what is actually being spoken is less important, or, you know, like, it's not critical to telling the story and making you feel what you're supposed to feel in the scenes.
It could be almost like opera, where you don't necessarily understand everything, but you get there's a general sense of what's happening and you can sense the emotion and everything.
Yeah.
So it didn't work for me, and it was supposed to. And I was reading all these things about the brilliance of this movie, and, you know, Scarlett Johansson was a voice, Bryan Cranston, you know, but then, like, Bill Murray, Jeff Goldblum.
How did they fuck this up?
There wasn't enough of a story to carry, there wasn't enough of a plot to carry out. It was like they had a very small idea, but then they had a ton of quirky things that on their own are kind of funny. But when you put those all together without really a story, it just was like, didn't really make any sense to me. So at some point, we just left with 20 minutes left. And as we left, the manager of the movie was like, is that movie only an hour and 21 minutes? She was asking somebody.
It's not.
I mean,
it's just terrible.
I just kept waiting. And then I'm Googling on my phone in the theater, how long is this movie? And I told Mike, I'm like, there's like 20 minutes left. He's like, let's just go.
Yeah, I don't. Whatever happens in those next 20 minutes are not going to, that's not going to bring it around, probably.
No. And I fell asleep a couple of times too. And so did he. So that's what happened.
Well, I'm going to watch that movie and
go see it and see what you feel about it.
Yeah. Maybe I'll wait till it comes down here to the theater that's like right by my house.
Yeah. I bet it'll be there next week.
Yeah. It's just going to cycle through and get to the budget theaters in no time.
Everybody who wanted to see it will have already seen it by the end of this week.
You could probably say that now.
Yeah. there was hardly anybody in there.
Okay.
And everybody looked like they were pretty hip, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were still just sitting there in silence. So.
Probably a lot of film students.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can apply your film study background to this movie and tell me where maybe I was missing something.
Yeah.
I'm open to that.
Because maybe you lack the taste and sophistication to appreciate a movie of that caliber. I'll let you
You've
know.
You've got spirited eyes right now, like you just know you're being annoying. So what do you want? You had something you're going to tell me about.
So have you ever heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
Yes, I have.
So like this big floating island of plastic in the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, there are some people who claim it's not real.
Well,
is it not?
It was interesting because I wanted to answer that question because I saw there was an article about some Dutch high school student who came up with a plan to like clean plastic out of the ocean, you know.
Okay.
And they're sending, you know, like this project to like where this is, and so I was like, well, I want to see pictures of this thing, right?
Yeah, I think I've heard of this student.
Yeah, I forget his name. That's not really the point of what I wanted to talk about. We can all get behind. I think we can all get behind an effort to clean plastic out of the ocean. That's a good thing, no matter what.
Right. Right? That's not a partisan issue.
Right. But what was interesting is like, because you know, when people talk about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, you know, you think of this like mass of plastic. Right, like the size of, I mean, I've heard things like the size of Texas or the size of France or like,
yeah,
you know, and you'd think it would be like this thing. The way people talk about it is like this big thing that like an island that you could see from like a satellite image or something, right? And so I was like, uh-huh. Man, I want to see what this thing actually looks like. There's got to be photographs, right? And it's really hard to find a picture, like an actual picture of it,
like an aerial view,
right? And so I actually looked it up on the NOAA website.
Yeah,
and they've got a great article about it, a great little, you know, kind of little 2-paragraph or 3-paragraph article about it. And this is what they have to say about it. Says the name Pacific Garbage Patch has led many to believe that this area is a large and continuous patch of easily visible marine debris items such as bottles and other litter, akin to a literal island of trash that should be visible with satellite or aerial photographs.
Yes.
While higher concentration of litter items can be found in this area, along with other debris such as derelict fishing nets, much of the debris is actually very small. The small pieces of floating plastic that are not immediately evident to the naked eye. The debris is continuously mixed with wind and wave action and widely dispersed over huge surface areas throughout the top portion of the water column. It is possible to sail through the garbage patch area and see very little or no debris on the water's surface. So they actually have a diagram on attached to this article that kind of shows the prevailing currents,
yeah,
through the Pacific Ocean, and kind of like, because it's not like one spot, you know, because you know like a lot of people talk about it being, you know, this one spot the size of Texas between San Francisco and Hawaii, you know, but
yeah,
it's actually there would be, you know, that is it. There's a concentration there where it kind of, you know, because that's kind of where south of Hawaii is where, you know, the current kind of flows through the Pacific Ocean from west to east and then kind of curls up as it comes to the west coast of North America and then curls back, you know, back the other way. So the debris tends to circle there. And there's also a patch kind of like that by Japan, kind of where the current kind of circles around back the other way.
Sure.
You know. So when you talk about like it being the size of Texas, it's like, yes, that's technically true. It's hard to define, you know, the boundaries of it, because it's, you know, it's just like debris circling in the ocean, mm-hmm, you know. But it's, you know, it's not, there is not a like
floating cohesive thing.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which is exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I mean, that's not to say that there isn't like a shitload of plastic in the ocean and we shouldn't try to get it out. But I think the way it's pitched and sold is, I don't know if it's disingenuous. I don't know if people are doing it on purpose or, you know, like where they're outright trying to mislead people to, mm-hmm, try to make the problem seem more urgent.
Yeah.
Or people just don't understand necessarily what's happening out there. You know, so I just, you know, like that kind of grabbed my attention because it was one of those things where I was like, well, I was genuinely curious. Like, I want to see this thing, you know, and it's like, oh, wait a second. It's not what I thought it was.
The only photos I've seen had been like close up of just like a very small section.
Right.
In which I would think, oh, wow, if I million Drupaled that, holy shit.
Yeah, that's a lot of plastic.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. And, you know, like if that were the case, if it were something like that, you know, like, I mean, images of that would be all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, like it would be a very easy thing to photograph.
Yeah.
So, but this is still a problem. It's just a harder to photograph problem.
Yeah.
You know, which makes it, you know, I think maybe makes it seem a little less urgent to people. Maybe that's why, you know, they kind of pitch it in this way. Or, you know, like advocates for like environmental advocacy or whatever.
And technically, that's not wrong. But the picture that gives people puts much more panic than what the reality of what it looks like is.
Right, right.
Yeah, because people do need things to be dire until
to actually act on them, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I wanted to know if this thing was real.
That's so weird.
And so people who say it's not real, you know, I mean, it's kind of one of those things. Like, well, what are we using to define that? You know, like because it's the floating island doesn't appear to be real. You know, but the problem of plastic and fishing nets and debris and stuff like that in the ocean, just like hanging out there, you know, like that is a problem.
Yeah.
That should be addressed.
Yeah.
So, you know, like most things in the world, most things in reality, it's the truth lies somewhere in between.
Yep. We were just talking about that with that Yeti coolers. There was this meme floating around Yeti coolers booted the NRA from advertising, so we're going to boycott Yeti, you know, people who were pissed about Yeti giving NRA the boot are like, oh, I'm not buying those anymore. Then there's another meme that came out that's like, well, actually what happened is the NRA was part of some advertising program that was no longer viable at Yeti coolers, so they discontinued that for everybody and then offered the NRA some other program for advertising instead. You know, so it's just like everything. And of course, where did I see this plastic on the beach thing? Facebook. That's where I saw it.
Right.
So then I'm just like, wow, there's this thing. And when you asked me, do you know about that? I was like, yeah. But do I really? Well, no. I just know what I read on there.
Right. Yeah, and that's I think that's something that's it's important to hit that reset button once in a while, you know, and just kind of realize that, because I think it's really easy to kind of passively incorporate things into our worldview. You know, like you literally scroll past it on Facebook. You know, like you don't really maybe you don't read the article.
Yeah,
you know, but you're just like, oh wow, that's a crazy thing. Okay, what's Jimmy up to?
Yeah,
yeah,
hey, you know? Jimmy.
Yeah, you know, so it's important to realize, I think, that a lot of the stuff, and not just like Facebook, but a lot of the stuff that we absorb, that we incorporate into and take for granted, in, you know, that make up our worldview. I'm really wording this in the worst way possible, but you know, it's good to realize that there is a lot of fault with that system.
Yeah,
you know, like the system of intake or uptake of news. You know that you got to pay attention to that stuff once in a while and see if what you're reading is actually true. Like is it actually true or does it just feel true?
Yeah,
you know, because
we've talked about that on here,
right?
Yeah, because as much as I joke about that, feeling true isn't the best policy.
No, it's right, because we are much more likely to incorporate something into our worldview that feels right, whether or not it actually is.
Yeah, because it fits with our worldview.
Right. Because if something is true but doesn't fit that worldview, you've got to reconfigure. Your brain has to reconfigure all of the other stuff in your head, because your reality to you as a human being is your brain telling you a story. And mm-hmm. and all of the pieces have to make sense in that story. Otherwise, like, it starts having problems, you know, mm-hmm. like, and it just starts rejecting things, whether they're objectively true or not. It will just reject things that don't fit.
Yeah.
So, and that's, I mean, not to get all like political, but that's why we have like two political parties instead of like four or five.
Yeah.
Because it's really easy to create a narrative that is, you know, polar opposite of something else.
Yeah. Once it becomes a little more nuanced, like, well, it's kind of in between. Anyway.
Yeah. Human beings are not great at nuance.
No. And who's going first this week?
I'll go first. Okay. I got something weird to tell you.
Yeah. Tell me it.
So, now, I usually dwell in the 1800s. But
yeah, you do. Is it the 1600s?
This is the 1500s.
Oh, Lordy.
And in the 1500s, Spain is in the New World just killing it.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
Just slaughtering. And now, somehow, if you can believe this, the Spaniards had actually talked like the Aztecs and the Incas into telling them where all the valuable stuff was. Possibly
talked
through,
in hash, like in quotes.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Maybe through like murder and torture.
Right.
And now they were sending literal boatloads of gold back to Spain. You know, like they were just like, they were just filling up ships with as much gold as they could carry and sending them back.
Wow.
And which Spain was then using, they were spending all of that newfound wealth in wise and responsible ways. Like by waging war against Europe and North Africa. So England was way behind in the colonization game. And they wanted a piece of the action. You know, like they wanted to be big players in the world, and they really weren't yet.
Yeah.
You know, because we think of England, especially like we think of England in America as always being kind of like a world power, but this is kind of like as England was kind of building itself up, you know. And of course, you know, England wanted to establish itself in North America because it wanted some of that sweet, sweet gold action.
Yeah.
You know? And so Queen Elizabeth I granted a colonization charter to Sir Humphrey Gilbert. And Gilbert had the idea. So are you familiar with the idea of the Northwest Passage?
Mm-hmm.
So they thought there was a route through essentially like kind of north of Canada. That would get them around the continent and down to the West Indies, where all that amazing trading bounty existed.
Now, of course, you know where I'm wondering, where is this in proximity to the Panama Canal? Sorry, I know.
It's quite a ways north of the Panama Canal. Like,
I'm just trying to help the listeners get oriented.
Right, right. Yeah.
Everything is sort of like, in, you know, the Panama Canal serves for most people.
Okay, all right. So you know,
as the heart,
right? That like that's the landmark that everybody knows, Panama Canal. Now you know the North Pole,
yeah.
Right. Okay. So those are your two points of reference. A little closer to the North Pole than to Panama Canal.
Okay.
Okay.
So closer to Santa Claus.
Right. Right. And so, which I'm kind of surprised they didn't just go straight up to see Santa.
Yeah, they should have just robbed Santa.
I mean, well, we'll get to the robbery. So Gilbert thought he was going to be the guy to find the Northwest Passage, and so he wasn't real concerned about setting up a permanent colony. You know, so they were really kind of looking for more of a trading outpost so that they could, you know, find some vulnerable savages and exploit them.
Yeah.
You know, to find the gold and then use that base of operations to find the Northwest Passage. And then then England would be like on the map. So now the other, I mean, they're going to use this as a base of operations for exploratory ships, of course, but it was also going to be a base for English privateers who were kind of moving into the area to capture Spanish treasure ships. Because, like, the ocean is just lousy with Spanish treasure ships. Like, and so England's like, we're going to take some.
They're just, it's fishing.
Yeah, so it's fishing for, like, human beings who are transporting gold.
Yeah. And
the human beings are totally expendable, but the gold is definitely not.
Right, and if you're out there, you might get caught. It's like sharks, you know?
I mean, if you're on a ship with a bunch of gold on it, you're taking your life in your own hands, kind of.
Yeah.
You know? Sir Humphrey Gilbert... makes it as far as a fishing outpost near Newfoundland, and he goes out in his boat and he starts carving up some sick waves or whatever, and he dumps his boat and he drowns. But Gilbert's half-brother, Sir Walter Raleigh, petitions the Queen to give him Gilbert's charter. Raleigh was... Well, he had a relationship with Queen Elizabeth.
He did?
They were kind of...
I remember. I think I remember hearing that. That's probably how I know his name.
Yeah, and you probably also heard of Raleigh, North Carolina.
No.
Yeah. So the Queen was real sweet on Raleigh. You know, they were smashing it a little bit. And so she tells him, yes, you can have the charter, but you're not going.
Because she had some investment in him.
Yeah, yeah. So he puts together a team who's just like the best of the best. And with this charter, he had to establish a colony within 6 years. So by 1584.
You almost said 18.
I did. Well, there's an 8 in it. Like, what am I going to do?
Right.
So 1584, they've got to have this colony set up, right? So he's got to get his shit together on the east coast of North America, like, immediately.
Whoa.
Right. So, because, I mean, six years back then is like, you know, that'd be like 6 days now.
Yeah.
So he starts putting together his team. You know, uh-huh. He's like, so what do I need? I need sailors. I need soldiers. I need a diver. I need an accountant. I need an explosives expert, a safe cracker, a wisecracking computer hacker, a contortionist.
That's not for real.
No, he does bring sailors, soldiers, and some cartographers, you know.
Are there any ladies on board?
Oh, no, not this one. Not this time. Mm-hmm. Ladies can't explore. Everybody knows that. Everybody in 1584 knows
they
that.
They can explore one area repeatedly.
Right,
as far as
right.
Guys
that's,
are concerned.
That's right. Exactly. So he also brought John White, who was an artist.
Oh, and like a drawing artist.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and actually there are some really amazing John White drawings about this whole thing. So they go to a spot in North Carolina. The whole area, they called the whole area Virginia after Queen Elizabeth, who is known as the Virgin Queen.
Well,
not after Sir Raleigh got after her. And there's a ton of stuff on the East Coast named after Queen Elizabeth. It's like apparently like all the dudes of the area wanted to get some.
Virginia is for lovers.
That's what they say.
Whoa.
Yeah. So they settle on Roanoke Island. And the people who already lived there were the Secotans and the Croatoans. And the Secotans and the Croatoans were pretty friendly. You know, they see a bunch of, you know, English people come out of the sea and they're just like, hey, what do you guys got? We got some stuff.
Yeah.
Let's figure this out. And so they started trading. And mostly the English were interested in trading for food because they were just like so many like early colonists, they were just totally useless at like sustaining their own. Like it's like they definitely weren't interested in sending farmers on the first couple of trips, you know, or hunters.
Food comes from the kitchen.
Yeah, well, food comes from the Native Americans.
Yeah, but they were coming with a mindset. They probably had really no connection to where food really. These guys, yeah. You know, weren't.
Well, they're right, because these are like rich English dudes, yeah. Like noblemen and stuff. So they were just like, food comes from my servants.
Yeah.
I send them to the food getting place, and they come back with food.
The food getting place.
So the English are pretty. They're pretty pleased with the deal that they worked out. You know, like they're like, yes, this is it. This is going to be our spot. So. The team packs up their stuff and comes back to England, you know, and they huddle up to talk about some stuff. And they ultimately decide that, you know, like the natives, the trading, the being in North America, this is the spot, this place right here on Roanoke Island. So they decide to put together a second expedition to the same site. This time, no artists, just troops. Like, we're just going to send soldiers. Soldiers and people who know how to find gold. So, this is basically... Roanoke is basically England's get-rich-quick scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soldiers get there and start asking the Secotans and the Croatoans, like... If they know if they've got any shiny stuff, or like, do you know where any of the shiny stuff is? You know, the goal is they want to make a big splash right away to make their investors happy. You know, uh-huh. So that they can finance more of this. You know, like, this is the whole plan. It's to like, you know, it's like seed money.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like we're gonna make this, we're gonna plant this seed on Roanoke Island, and we're gonna grow it into golden banana. I don't know. I'm losing my metaphor. Anyways. They didn't really find... Because the idea is they're either going to find gold or they're going to steal it from the Spanish or both, right? And we all remember learning about in school, like remember sitting in like history class and learning about the great North Carolina gold rush of the 1500s.
Mm-hmm. Of the 1500s?
No, because it didn't happen because there isn't any gold there. Oh. Not in any measurable amount.
Yeah, I just heard gold rush and thought San Francisco.
Yeah.
And that was the 1800s, right?
Right, yeah. So they're digging around. They're trying to find it. Find something that isn't there. And all of a sudden, you know, like it's fall and then it's winter and the soldiers are stuck there.
Ooh. And
so now these soldiers, these English soldiers, they were veterans of the English campaign in Ireland. And England did not treat the Irish particularly well.
Yeah.
You know, so these are people who they were brutality hardened assholes. Like these are people who just got done like burning villages and decapitating people and putting like heads on spikes like in town squares and stuff, you know. And now they're stuck on a dumpy island and the soldiers are about to start shit up with the Cicatellans, or the Cicatans, sorry. So they're all hungry, and they don't know how to fend for themselves. And so they march over to one of the Cicatan villages and just grab a bunch of food. And
God, this attitude feels so familiar to us here, doesn't it?
So they grab a bunch of food. The Cicatans are just like, what the fuck, guys? You know, and the soldiers get back to their camp. They're hanging out, and all of a sudden, a silver cup belonging to one of the English assholes goes missing. And so they're just like, where's our cup, assholes?
Where's our cup?
Yeah, cough up the cup. And the Cicatans are just like, the fuck are you guys talking about, cup? Like, we don't have a cup. Do you see anything? Do you see a silver cup laying around here?
Yeah.
And so they talk about it. Calmer heads prevail, and everything worked out fine. Just kidding. The soldiers got all pissed off and just started killing a bunch of people.
Over this cup.
Over the cup, yep.
That probably somebody else in their own party took.
Somebody probably lost it. Yeah. You know, like, who knows what happened to it? But yeah, the cup goes missing. They kill a bunch of Cicatans, and the Cicatans start kind of fighting back. And Sir Francis Drake, the pirate,
yeah,
the English pirate, he shows up. Actually, he was on a scheduled supply run. He was probably what his plan was to bring supplies and then go rob a Spanish ship on his way back. Instead, a bunch of the soldiers actually just load up onto his ship and take off. Because they're just like, we don't want to be here anymore. So despite all of this, they decide that this is still the place. We still got it. We got to find a place to set up this base in the New World. And so they decide that they're going to go back. They bring 107 people. And they're going to come back in a year for another resupply, right?
Okay.
So one of the guys, they sail out, and they set up, they build a small fort on the north end of the island, and on their way out, they capture a Spanish ship, the Santa Maria de San Vicente, and they sailed it back to England. So the next shipment, or the next expedition to the island, they decide, okay, the soldiers pissed them off. Let's bring families. So let's bring some, like, women and children, and, you know, like, you know, let's make this a little more of a peaceful effort.
Yeah.
So they get there, they set up camp, they go to the Cicatoan, or the Cicatans.
Cicatoans.
There's the Croatoans, and that's where I keep combining the names. But yeah, the Cicatans. And they're just like, hey, we got to, like, check us out, you know? Like, we're back. And we brought families.
Yes, we're real people.
We're actual real people. How about some food?
For and more people now.
If you can believe it. Now, the Cicatans are just like, they're a little wary of the English now, you know? And they're like, you know what? We don't like this. This isn't, we're not comfortable with this. You want us to trade food, but we know you're just going to come and take it.
Yeah.
So no, you can't be here. So, in the meantime, Raleigh is back in England, and he's like, you know what? I don't know if the Roanoke thing is going to work or not. So let's come up with a backup plan and go to Chesapeake Bay. You know, like that seemed like an okay site. You know, we'll send 115 people there. And John White, the artist, was with them.
And I think there must be some famous paintings, right?
Yeah,
totally. From that.
Yep. Yeah. So John White was actually, during the voyage, they appointed him governor of the Chesapeake Bay Colony. And they were supposed to stop at Roanoke to pick up the people that were left behind, or the, you know, the people that were, you know, the families and stuff. Now,
oh no,
included in that group was John White's wife and child. Actually, the first, it was his child name was named Virginia Dare, who is the first English-born person in North America.
Wow.
So
must have been a fun time for his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus Christ.
So they come back and nobody's around. They can't find anybody.
Oh no.
So they're looking all over the place. And they go to the spot where the houses were, where the village was built, and the houses aren't there anymore. I mean, the materials are there, but the houses were, now they weren't destroyed. They were disassembled. Like they were going to transport the material somewhere else. So
what?
Yeah. So they were just dismantled. And they found the only evidence of a human they found was one skeleton, the skeletal remains of one human that might have been part of like the English guard that was with them. And there was a word carved into a fence post that was still standing. The word was Croatoan. And that is literally all we actually know about what happened to the people.
Are you kidding me?
At the Roanoke colony.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a whole colony of people that just disappeared. You know, it was like 115 or so people that just disappeared.
And the word Croatoan.
Yeah. So now there's some theories about, you know, what probably happened. You know,
they all moved to Atlantis.
Well, that's one theory. you know, I mean, conditions on Roanoke Island are not not great. I mean, it's not a fantastic place to be.
Yeah.
And you know, they probably had a hard time, you know, like finding food. I mean, especially if the Sea Catans weren't willing to trade with them. So a lot of people think that they just moved inland and like joined up with Native American tribes, you know, like the could have been the Croatoans, but once they realized that all the people were gone, they just GTFO'd. Like all the English people just were like, well, we're not going to stay here.
And so wow.
they never pursued it any further. You know, like they never like.
That could have been telling them go to the Croatoans.
Right.
Or it could have been.
Or maybe, you know, one theory is that the Croatoans came and killed them.
Yeah. And somebody was able to indicate.
Right.
But it was disassembled.
Yeah.
That's so, very weird.
Yeah. They didn't leave in a hurry. There's no question about that. There was a very deliberate thing, you know. So And it could have just been like people were just starving and they just had to get out.
Yeah.
You know, and just go wherever they could. So they think maybe some people got to the mainland and then just like went north and tried to, you know, join up with some people there. You know, it would have been real tough for English people to like go find some like Spaniards to hang out with. It's like relations were not super good.
Right.
So that's the lost colony of Roanoke.
That's really unsettling. Yeah. It just ends.
Yeah, it's kind of spooky.
Wow. Sorry for all this. You people are
I'll edit it out.
Oh, no, you can't. It's too constant. Just edit me out.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I meant.
Well, guess what? I'm going to talk about a serial killer.
I don't want to guess what. Why don't you just tell me?
I'm going to tell you something weird and brutal. And it's about a serial killer that lived in Minnesota. And as a matter of fact, Robert Dudley mentioned him as a potential suspect in the Mary Schlace, the hitchhiker case. It was somebody who had been floated around as a potential, and his name is Joe. Well, I'm not going to tell you. Hey, Joe, what do you know?
It's old Cup of Joe.
Because it starts this way, say. It doesn't start exactly. And we're just having a laugh about something outside.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
In the early morning of December 15th, 1978, Alice Hulling and three of her four children were shot to death in their beds at their rural home near Clearwater, Minnesota. Only 11-year-old Billy survived when he played dead under his covers as two shotgun blasts narrowly missed him. I'm trying to think of where Clearwater is. I can't place it in my head.
You know, I believe in French that would be Eau Claire.
Oh. Funny thing, we happened to record in Eau Claire.
Huh. Oh, weird.
Yeah. The murders remained a mystery for decades. Several potential suspects were considered, including a Stearns County, which is a book that Rob has just published about Stearns County cold cases, where Jacob Wetterling lived, deputy who lived nearby and has since died. It wasn't until 2000 that a jury convicted a drifter named Joe Turay, largely based on a confession he allegedly dictated to a fellow prisoner, something he denied doing. I did not do any of those murders, he said.
I did not.
I did not. Oh.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I ordered on Christmas Day the room and two shirts. I just got them.
Yes.
With a signed postcard from Tommy Wiseau.
No way.
That said, to Jody. Oh. It's like, hi, sorry. Hi. Oh, hi, Jody. Sorry, it took 5 months. You know, it didn't quite say that, but I feel like that's why I got it. I was starting to think I got ripped out of $50. I was like, well, I guess that's how that happens. But
I think things just happen on Tommy Wiseau time.
Yeah. So I did not do any of these murders. He said he was framed in order to close some cold cases. Okay, so this is what Joe Turay says. Investigators had Turay in their grips just 4 days after the murders happened. He was driving a car that had been reported stolen and was harassing waitresses at the Clearwater Travel Plaza near Interstate 94. One of the waitresses called the cops and said, I'm in there having breakfast. Oh, no, he calls. One of the waitresses called the cops. This is what Turay says about it. I'm in there having breakfast, and I'm trying to get a couple of dates with a couple of waitresses. This is how I get most of my dates, is with waitresses.
Yeah, I get most of my dates by harassing people. And if you, here's the thing. If you harass enough people, you know.
One out of 100 might stick.
Might say yes. So it's a numbers game. You see, you just got to harass enough people.
So the police took a look at his car. They found a metal rod wrapped in a steering wheel cover, a small toy car, and a ski mask.
What the fuck? all right. The toy car is... I'm a little hung up on that right now, but...
Well, you're going to get an answer to that here, because...
I don't... You know what? Actually, I think I'm good. I don't want it. I don't want to know.
Experts matched the rod to a bruise on Alice Hulling's body. Billy Hulling later described the toy car as similar to one of his that had gone missing. The items were turned over to Stearns County Sheriff's Deputy James Kostroba, who had been one of the first to arrive at that crime scene. He and another detective interviewed Touré, and after evading several questions, he was released.
Okay.
Stearns County has really got their shit together.
So,
they had a rod that matched a bruise on the woman's body.
And they know the rod belongs to this guy.
It's in his car anyway.
And
with a ski mask.
Yep.
And a car that's similar to the one that the little boy says is gone.
And they're just like, so they're like, all right, you have an explanation for these items? And he's all like, the rod is part of my garden rake that broke, and I'm on my way to get a new one. And when I was at the store, I bought this car for a kid that I know. And the ski mask is, well, it's Minnesota, you know, like it could get cold. And they're like, well, I think it checks out.
And you can actually hear, and I will link on our page to the answers. There's recording of the his real answers.
Oh man. And they're just like, they're like, all right, you just keep your nose clean. Get out of here.
So he was like, okay, I'll do that. So I'm going to go and conduct a string of rapes and murders for which he was later convicted. He is serving multiple life sentences right now at Stillwater State Prison. All right. So this guy was born in 1951. He spent most of his early life around St. Paul. He wound up in an orphanage and reformatory at age 10. He didn't get along with his mom's new wife and his dad.
His mom's new wife?
His father's new wife, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that'd be pretty progressive.
That would have been real progressive for the time.
His mom couldn't look after him. My ma, she was just moving around here and there, so she wasn't a fit person to live with, he said. So when he was 18, he joined the Marine Corps. He only made it for 6 months, and he came back to St. Paul. He couldn't hold a job.
Is there any record about, I'm sure there's record about how he left the Marine Corps, because usually they don't just say, like if things aren't working out for you in the Marine Corps and you're like, you know what, guys, actually, I changed my mind. They don't just let you go. Like, usually that's a decision if you're leaving after 6 months, they made that call.
Yeah, I'm sure he was I bet he has a dishonorable discharge. I'll look that up.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know. But, I mean, not that that is necessarily related to the rest of it, but,
yeah,
you know, things are starting to add up a little bit.
Yeah. So he gets a job.
Mostly it's the string of rapes and murders that are adding up for me.
Yeah. So he gets a job at the Ford plant in St. Paul, at junkyards and at car dealerships as a mechanic or lot man. Sometimes he lives in his car. So as a young man.
So things are looking up.
Yeah, so then he's like, you know what? I'm going to get myself some bushy sideburns, grow my hair out. I'm going to talk a lot, and I'm going to kind of establish myself as a truth teller.
Mm.
He said, I call a spade a spade. I had a lot of problems with some women because I tell them where it's at. If I don't like someone, I don't beat around the bush.
I mean, it sounds charming.
So in 1981, more than 2 years after the Hulling murders, he was convicted of abducting and raping an 18-year-old woman and a 13-year-old girl in separate incidents near Lake Street, Minneapolis. He was also convicted of attempting to kidnap and rape a 20-year-old woman who escaped by burning his face with a cigarette. After that, he was convicted of the 1980 abduction, rape, and murder of 19-year-old Diane Edwards.
Now, are these separate cases so he was like convicted and then like let go, like
no, this one happened before this. Okay. One, so he killed all those, well, the murders happened in 79, then he did all of these things in 81. then after that, he's convicted of something that happened back in 1980, which was the rape, abduction, and murder of 19-year-old Diane Edwards. Here's what's interesting about her is, do you remember the band Husker Du?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. Yeah. There's a song called Diane, and that's what that song's about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember that song specifically, but...
She was walking home from her job waitressing at a Perkins restaurant in West St. Paul when she was forced into a car. Her naked body was found face down in a ditch nearly 2 weeks later, her clothing piled beside her. He confessed to the murder, but said he was just playing games. Oh, he confessed, but then he said, well, I was just playing games with you guys, and I'm really innocent. So if you recall, when Robert Dudley was here, they thought Mary Schlace could have been a victim of his because he preyed on waitresses.
Sure, right,
yeah.
right.
And, yep. You know, he's always harassing waitresses.
And a great technique, if you're being interrogated by police, is to just mess around with them, you know.
Yeah, just play
just
games.
Like, oh, God. There was a couple weeks ago, there was a, I forget exactly who it was. Packers fans will know. There was a member of the Green Bay Packers who was at an airport, I think flying to Hawaii. And when he was like, you know, they were like going through security and, so the you know, there was the question about like, is there any, you know, anything explosive or anything, you know, whatever. And he goes to turns to his girlfriend and says, did you remember to pack the explosives?
Oh.
And so he was arrested. So don't, like, don't.
No, you've got to check that sense of humor.
You might be real funny. This guy was probably real funny. This guy, Joe, I'm sure, was like a regular comedian. He sounds super funny and charming.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
But, you know, the cops got to take that stuff seriously.
Right. And what happens with this guy, this was really a tricky one to put together because the times in which he did the things, you know, were dramatically different than when he got caught for them. And he was caught for different things at different times.
When was he caught?
So he was caught. He was convicted in 1981 of his first things.
Okay.
But he had done a lot of things before then that just had not caught up with him.
Well, I mean, Joe did a lot of living, it sounds like.
He really knew how to live because while he's already... was already living in prison. In 1998, he's convicted of bludgeoning to death 18-year-old Marlis Wollenhaus in her family's home in Afton, Minnesota. That was back in 1979, the same year that he murdered the family minus the one boy. So they convicted him on this partly based on the same dictated confession used in the Hulling prosecution. That's the family. I did a lot of bad things, Turi said. I stole from this and stole from that. I stole cars, shit like that. But I never hurt a body. I never hurt a certain person. If I burglarized something, it was a business and there was nobody there, hopefully.
I never hurt a certain person?
Yes.
It's like, nah, I just hurt a lot of like non-specific people.
Yes. So... Retired Stearns County Detective Lou Leland provided a different portrayal. I spent hours and hours and hours with him. He's a very mixed up character. He had a bad bringing up. Life was not easy for him. I don't feel sorry for him. But I can see why he kind of didn't like women and why he did probably more than what we got him for. So he is one of these people that I am pretty sure that... has done things they don't even know about because he keeps going back and forth, you know, on his confessions and, oh, I didn't really mean that one or, oh, you know.
Yeah. Or other ones where he's just like, hey, I did it.
Yeah.
Well, actually I didn't, but it'd be pretty awesome if I did. Right.
So of the Hulling murders, Leland, who's this retired Stearns County detective, said he did the deed. So there was a bunch of press about this, because of the fact that this guy would confess to things and then take it back. And it was just a big bureaucratic nightmare for the judicial system there in Minnesota. So finally, in 2001, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld his conviction for the Hulling murders. And in 2004, 1994, upheld his conviction for the Woolenhouse murder. Those were the two that came in that confession that he told a fellow prisoner and then denied doing. So he denied that confession to the fellow prisoner. He denied the other stuff to the cops, saying he was just playing games. So in his mind, he is completely innocent of anything. Although, you know, there are three people here. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like 8 people. But in his mind, he has done none of those.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're singling out victims, I mean, I can see you can mix up words and make it sound any way you want.
Yeah.
You know, but like,
it's Stillwater. He's not dead. He's alive and he's serving out the rest of his life in Stillwater, Minnesota right now. So, ladies.
Waitresses.
Yeah. So that's mine this week. Yeah. It's kind of a short one, but, you know, packs a little bit of a murdery punch.
Hey, that's my favorite kind of punch.
Yeah. Do you got to raise sunshine?
You know, I mean, is it unfair to use the actual sunshine as a ray of sunshine?
No, why don't we can do that? Weather.
Oh, man, this... So, I mean, I'm sure, like, well, everybody listening in the United States probably is aware of, you know, like, in the last, the absolute garbage weather that we've all been dealing with, or most of us have been dealing with, for a while. Like, this has been a long, terrible winter. And you know what? I don't get. You know, I'm just going to say that as a blanket statement. And you know what? If you're the kind of person who likes snow, you and I probably won't get along very well.
Yeah.
But it's the weather has turned in a tremendously awesome way. It has been for like the last 3 or 4 days here. It has been downright bearable. It has been like tolerable outside. You can actually go outside. I actually went out. I was sitting on my porch. I had a bunch of papers to write for a class I sat out on my porch and just like hammered away on them. It was just delightful.
Yeah. Hey, you know what else I'm going to throw out there? It was record store day this last Saturday on my birthday.
And it was like the only. So if you want deals on records, get in your time machine.
Well, there's stuff left at Revival downtown because I was just in there again yesterday. And one of the records I got, which is still down there, is called The Other Side of Sun. It's Sun Records. It's the sort of unreleased tracks from artists you probably don't know, and it's all got this great Motown sound. It's like the classic Sun Records sound from hundreds of artists that recorded there that probably just didn't quite make it all the way, or didn't have a lot of, maybe had one hit or something like that.
How amazing would it have been if there was like some like version of like Spotify or something. Ooh. Like in that era.
Yeah. You know,
because I'm sure there were just like, there's so many amazing musicians who just never, like, well, like, you know, it's just lost.
It's lost. And these are curated by Tito's. Tito's Vodka is involved in this. So you get this cool little insert that's this art from Tito's. And the record is only like $13 right now. And there was one last year too that they might still have some copies of, but they are just great. Like Mike Peake heard the first one when I was playing it one day, and he was like, "This sounds like music I'd hear in like a cool restaurant." I was like, "Fuck yeah!" So anyway, that's my ray of sunshine.
Yeah. Well, I got to get down there and
You should probably
buy
get
some
it.
Things.
Yeah,
is I missed record day, but a record store day. I mean,
yeah.
Follow
our Facebook page. Yeah. Keep listening. We'll be throwing some dates out there as soon as we have them for things coming.
Yeah, because we have some things in the works, and it's going to all be amazing. And I expect every last one of you to be there. No excuses. It's mandatory.
Yep.
Have a weird week.